straightforwardly to us under the Oregon Constitution.
Let us take the problem. Let's assume that all of the local jurisdiction ordinances are rendered invalid by the decisions of the Court of Appeals and subsequently by the Oregon Supreme Court. And let us assume that this body adopts a criminal forfeiture statute. And let's look at where that will leave Oregon at that point. And where that will leave Oregon is as a magnet for conduct that's covered by this bill. And the reason for that is that if this jurisdiction adopts any state forfeiture statute, whether it be criminal or civil, which directs the uses to which that money may be put, then we will have, by virtue of the language of the federal law, removed the federal alternative from our arsenal of tools. In other words, if we were to adopt a criminal forfeiture statute with all the attendant limitations that that will have, we could not then resort to the federal law. And the only remedy we would have in Oregon would be the criminal forfeiture statute created by this body. And by all counts, criminal forfeiture statutes are not nearly as effective as a broad civil forfeiture statute. And so the consequence of adopting a criminal forfeiture statute as opposed to a civil forfeiture statute of broad scope would be disastrous in terms of making Oregon a place for people to come and do business in these kind of activities.
Other questions, Corey? Madam Chair, Representative Clark, if I could add an additional answer to your question. The legislature does have the power to require that property be forfeited civilly, regardless of whether or not the conduct which gives rise to the forfeiture is a criminal violation. The legislature could choose, for example, to enforce the unfair trade practices law through a forfeiture system that would require when a boiler room operation was conducted, for example, that the telephone equipment being used to conduct the boiler room operation forfeited. It is a civil enforcement proceeding. In this case, the confusion arises, I believe, because the conduct which gives rise to the forfeiture also is criminal conduct and is defined in that way. But it would be possible for the criminal statutes to be repealed and the forfeiture stay in place. Indeed, I believe this body is considering, or has been suggested that the body may wish to consider, a vehicle forfeiture law that would tie to driving while suspended and would concurrently decriminalize the offense of driving while suspended so as to remove it from the indigent defense system, among other things. It is convenient in this case to define the conduct giving rise to the forfeiture in terms of the criminal law because it is already so defined, but that does not make the forfeiture a criminal penalty.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you.
I'd like to, switch over to section 10, having to do with the disbursement of the assets. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more. As I read it, it says that money goes to political subdivision. If it is not a county, it's deposited in the general fund. But it says that if it is a county, and then it says it shall be used for, but I guess I'm not sure how that works. Can you say a little bit more, and then I'll ask you something else?
Madam Chair, Representative Calori, there are actually people here prepared to testify today who can speak with much more authority to those provisions of this bill, and I suggest you.
Representative Mannix.
Can you tell me where you find, or what you define as the operative provision regarding the standard of proof? And we already can see the burden of proceeding here because the procedures are lined out very nicely. But in terms of the burden of proof in a forfeiture proceeding, when somebody, it's easy when nobody responds. Nobody responds, you walk in and you win. But somebody responds, claims an interest in the property, say, I read this as providing that where it's not inconsistent with this act, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure will apply. And under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, we're talking preponderance of the evidence normally. Is there some operative provision here that I'm missing that kicks in?
Madam Chair, Representative Maddox, there is a specific provision. It's in Section 13 on page 11 of the bill, lines 37 to 39. It follows the language of the equivalent federal statute and provides that the in effect the government has the burden of coming forward first with probable cause before the property is subject to forfeiture, and thereupon the burden of persuasion lies upon the claimant. Now, it does not say that the burden of persuasion is proved by a preponderance in that provision, but again, as you point out, the ordinary burden would be, unless otherwise specified, a preponderance.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We have some David Fidanke. We have some other proponents of amendments, and I'm going to call anybody who has amendments to the bill first, and we'll get the discussion of those taken care of, and then go ahead with the other witnesses who are signed up. Good afternoon, Mr. Fidanke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am David Fidanke, Associate Director of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to make some general comments first and then speak to our proposed amendments. I did participate in the working group on this issue, which was the identical working group which worked on the nuisance bill, which you've already had a hearing on this session. I also participated in an informal working group during the last session on House Bill 3069, which was the forfeiture bill introduced last session. That bill was approved in House Judiciary Subcommittee and subsequently died following that action, never got to full committee, and I'll speak to why I think that happened in a few minutes. A number of questions have come up today that I'd like to address. To start with, I hope this committee will recognize that this bill would provide an extraordinary remedy for dealing with certain criminal offenses, one that has not previously been in Oregon statutes, which would allow for the seizures of property in many more cases than is currently the case. And I want to start by saying that the ACLU has no problem with taking the profit out of crime. We believe that there are a number of situations where the profits connected with crime and the instrumentalities connected with crime can be seized properly by the government. Our primary problem with the proposal before you today is the manner in which that seizure takes place. In the context of the federal statutes, which have been alluded to by the previous witnesses, the ACLU of Oregon currently has a case which is pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is referred to in Pete Shepard's compendium, his written compendium on House Bill 2282. It's United States versus Tax Lot 1500. That is currently pending a petition for rehearing in the Ninth Circuit. And the primary issue at this point, we believe, is whether or not the seizure under the federal statute of real property, that is the whole or an entire tract of land involved in illegal drug activity, amounts to a forfeiture of estate in a civil in rem proceeding. And on that specific constitutional issue, the federal constitution does have a provision relating to forfeitures of estate. It's contained in Article 3, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution, and provides that forfeitures of estate may be carried out, but only in cases of treason, and then only for the life of the person convicted of treason. And the history here, I think, is instructive. And parenthetically, for more history, behind forfeitures and the precedent for forfeitures, I would encourage the committee members and staff to look at three law review articles. One is called The Goring Ox, An Historical Perspective on Civil Forfeitures, which appears in 46 Temple Law Quarterly 169, 1973. Civil and Criminal Penalties and Forfeitures, 60 Minnesota Law Review 379, 1976. And Forfeitures, Civil or Criminal, 43 Temple Law Quarterly 191, 1970. It is the ACLU's belief that the fundamental due process issues relating to forfeitures have not been squarely dealt with by the courts, certainly not at the state level. In the context of the
Just
state
a moment,
constitution.
Mr. Fidenke, Representative Mannix.
Yes.
On that point, as I read this bill, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. If I own a farm of, say, 100 acres, and I grow one marijuana plant in my backyard at the farm, there's no real limitation as to how far the state can go. When I read this provision about its forfeiture, it says all real property, which is used, intended to be used in any manner or part to commit or facilitate in any manner the commission of prohibited conduct. Now, maybe, am I going too far in saying, well, maybe, say, all right, I build a greenhouse and I've got one marijuana plant inside of it, then that whole greenhouse was intended to facilitate the protection of the marijuana plant. By the way, I'm separating the fact that we limit 5 grams in 1 ounce. Let's just throw that out for a minute, just use this as an extreme example. What you're getting at is that there's no limitation here with that kind of language as to how far you could go on, particularly on real property.
Exactly. And that is the identical provision in the federal statute which we are challenging in that federal case.
On the other hand, with the same 100-acre farm, say we transport that instead out into timberland, and I've got 100 acres of timberland, but actually underneath all those trees, I've got 100 acres of marijuana plants. Now, that's the other extreme. Have you come up with some format where we can try to make them forfeit that land because of the amount of activity?
There, one argument which we have put forward, and the standard which has been used as a matter of interpretation in the context of the revenue statutes relating to illegal distillation of alcohol under federal law, is that only the portion of the property actually used for illegal purposes may be forfeited to the state. That would be one way of ensuring some proportionality. On the other hand, in a criminal forfeiture case, again in federal court, again in the Ninth Circuit, where there clearly are criminal due process protections and the Eighth Amendment applies, the Ninth Circuit has said that there must be a balancing between the value of the contraband and the value of the property. And only so much property as would equal the value of the contraband could be subject to forfeiture under the criminal forfeiture statute. The Ninth Circuit, at least in its initial decision in our case, has held that Eighth Amendment protection does not apply in the civil in rem forfeiture proceeding.
One more
Representative
question.
Mannix, if you could
but
wait
that's another
a second with your question, and Mr. Fidenke, counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mannix, this was an issue that the working group wrestled with for quite a bit of time. And we ran into a lot of these problems. One of the problems with the one marijuana plant is, let's assume you take part of the land, let's say a farm, 100 acres, and you take a half acre. We have now accomplished through the forfeiture proceedings, which you can't do under the land use. And that is subdivide farmland. We also had the other problem, the fact is, how do you value that piece of land? We even talked about the issue of putting a lien on the property for the value of the land involved. And it almost wound up in as a medieval theological and philosophical discussion of trying to value the land for the one marijuana plant.
Getting back to that report, may I? That proportionality issue? Proportionality is really the court's way of making policy judgments when the legislature hasn't made a policy judgment. So if we can make the policy judgment and draw some specific lines, we probably won't have that problem. Is that right? Within reason.
I think that's true, Representative Mannix.
Has anyone toyed with the idea of saying, for instance, real property which is materially used in the production or storage, et cetera, some sort of key phrase where some judge can make some kind of a judgment as to whether or not we can really use the hammer? Materially is a nice legal word that means significantly, and it's been around for a long time. No answer to counsel? I'm asking counsel or the witness. I wasn't on the working group.
Representative Mannix, members of the committee, could you tell me what section you're specifically?
Well, they're proposing to pull real property out totally, which mm-hmm. concerns me because of the extreme, the positive extreme example. But I'm also concerned about the other extreme. If you can let us use the hammer on real property generally without any proportionality to it. And I'm talking about page 4, and I don't want to bog down the testimony. I'm getting us almost into work session. I was just looking for guidance as to whether anyone had done something with this. But it has to do with page 4, lines 13 through 15 in particular, relating to real property used, intended to be used in any manner or part. Now, if it said in a material manner or part, I'd be more comfortable.
We're getting a little assistance yeah. here from Mr. Shepherd. Why don't you go ahead?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, Mr. Taylor is correct. We really struggled with this in the working group. In fact, at one point, had a draft that we looked at that would have created a whole mechanism for having a hearing in effect. And we couldn't come up with a workable system. Your suggestion was not one that that occurred to us, and maybe it's something we can think about. The difficulty with the whole proportionality question is that the minute that we start to define categories of cases in which we don't give the full scope of forfeiture, then we have the case of the drug dealer who succeeds in unloading his yacht before we catch him. And when we catch him, what we catch him with are seeds and residue in the bottom of the yacht, or small quantities of cocaine that fell out of the packages. And then we have an almost insurmountable burden, even in showing probable cause, to believe that this person was anything more than the person who possessed just the residue. That's the problem with trying to define these lines. And so we made in House Bill 2282 exactly the kind of policy judgment that you've suggested, and that is if we've said that we'll ask the forfeiture counsel and the police agency to try and distinguish between those cases where it's an obvious hardship and those cases where it's not.
Thank you. Got your name all of a sudden, both of you actually. I was looking at this and thinking that the probable cause issue determine whether property would be subject to forfeiture would be possibly a key in the sense that in developing that probable cause, it would seem to me that you'd have to have some reason beyond just the simple mere fact that one existed on a piece of property. By understanding the probable cause, you have to have a totality of circumstances that creates either a conspiracy to commit a crime or makes it part of an overall scheme that involves the property that's going to be seized. So it's much bigger than just the mere fact that one plant located on a piece of property, at least in my mind.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, you're correct in the idea that the probable cause consists of an assembly or a mosaic of smaller facts, but in this case that mosaic would be complete if all you demonstrated was that one plant was growing on that property. That would be the sum total of the government's obligation under this bill.
What would you think about writing something in the probable cause aspect that would include something about the totality of the circumstances indicating that it's part of a criminal conspiracy or something of that nature, rather than trying to subdivide properties and those kinds of things?
That, again, is a potential that we didn't evaluate in the working group and is worth looking at, I think.
May I suggest one thing?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
Think about this. You may not want to answer this right now, but play with this idea on page 4, line 14. Adding one word where it says, talking about the property, which is used or intended to be used in any material manner or part. Materiality is something lawyers and judges deal with all the time. It's something that we can relate to. Lawyers and judges, it may be a term of art, but it means significantly. And that means if you have a single marijuana pot, you probably say, well, the earth that plant is in the pot is subject to forfeiture. But if you got a farm, then you might say, and it's all marijuana, then the whole farm is. Think about that as an idea, as something we might plug in here to avoid the overbroad concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. There are no other questions. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, if the committee would indulge me, I do have some more general comments. The ACLU, number one, has been arguing for more than 3 years now that local governments did not have the authority under existing law to enact the forfeiture ordinances they have enacted. In fact, the Court of Appeals agreed with us. It remains to be seen whether the Oregon Supreme Court will agree with us. In addition to that, however, we have been arguing that in rem forfeitures do not comply with the Oregon Bill of Rights, and have been urging both legislators and individuals connected with this process to look towards adding some of these provisions to the criminal statutes. We believe that eventually the courts are going to require this legislature to do that, that they will toss out this scheme just as they have tossed out the local ordinances. And the issue of forfeitures of estate, I think, is just one example of why we believe that is likely to happen. On page one of the printed bill, it states, line 32, that the remedies under this act are remedial and not punitive. That's all well and good. We believe that in many cases, in fact, these remedies will be punitive. And because of that, the courts will require criminal due process to be applied. Nevertheless, facing reality, it seems clear that this body is going to pass a civil in rem forfeiture statute this session. We took a look at House Bill 2282 and have suggested a number of amendments which we believe would make it less likely that this proposal would be subjected to constitutional attack. Again, let me specifically relate to the forfeiture of estate issue. That is an historical concept which dates back to feudal times, when a person convicted of a felony was prohibited from owning any property. We believe that by eliminating real property from the scope of this bill, except such real property which has been purchased with the proceeds of criminal activity, that the chances are such a forfeiture would withstand scrutiny under that forfeiture of estate provision. It seems clear to us, as Representative Edmondson pointed out earlier, that if you cannot forfeit someone's estate after you have convicted them of a crime, that you certainly can't forfeit their estate prior to convicting them of a crime, or if you have never even filed an accusatory instrument against the person. Now, it may be that the Oregon courts will look at this and say, as Mr. Shepherd has suggested, that because this is a civil proceeding, that provision of the Oregon Constitution doesn't apply. We think that strains credulity. Will obviously be arguing to the contrary when that issue is litigated. And I think another issue which was raised by members of the subcommittee relates to the purposes to which the funds under this act are placed following the forfeiture. And again, I want to point out to you that this is an extraordinary proceeding where the cards are stacked against the individual. This proposal in front of you has provided many protections, arguably for people who don't need them, financial institutions and others who have attorneys on staff or certainly have the funds to hire attorneys. The people who are not looked out for under this proposal are innocent individuals whose property is seized, where the government believes they have probable cause, but who cannot afford to hire an attorney, but whose entire assets may be tied up in this civil proceeding and may not be able to use those assets as collateral to hire an attorney to represent their property interests. But those are the folks we're concerned about. Again, I want to emphasize, we are not concerned about legitimate efforts to take property from people that are committing crimes. But if you look at the funding end result of this measure, it is to reward the very people who are carrying out these seizures and making the determinations about whether probable cause exists, particularly in the situations where there's no prior court review prior to the seizure. We believe that's bad policy. We believe that that is inviting mischief down the road, that at this point, certainly law enforcement agencies are going after the clear criminal targets. But there is a lot of money, potentially, involved in these property seizures.
Excuse me, Mr. Fedanke.
Yes.
Representative Minnis.
That's an interesting statement that you just made about not being subject to judicial probable cause is always subject to judicial review.
Prior.
In terms of prior to forfeiture, I mean, the officer may seize the property before it's ever going to be legitimately forfeited. It's going to go through a judicial proceeding, so there is judicial review. If they find there's no probable cause, you mean no purpose for forfeiture, so it's out the window. I don't understand your argument.
Representative Mannix, Madam Chair, as a practical matter, if a person cannot afford to hire an attorney, the forfeiture takes place at the time of seizure. Legally, that may not be the case. But if a person has no practical mechanism for protecting their rights, then they're going to lose. And I guess all I'm asking is that you think about those individuals, because while obviously we are all thinking about despicable characters today, down the road, as local governments and the state become more and more dependent on this measure as a source of revenue, the temptation is going to be to go after more marginal cases. And where the weight of the state and the cards in this proposal are stacked so heavily against the individual, that causes us grave concern, particularly where the people who are making those decisions end up receiving the proceeds from those forfeitures to use in their budgets. We would much rather see these funds go into the general fund of the state so that there would be no question as to the motives of the individuals carrying out the seizures.
Mr. Fedanke, let me ask you a question about the working group. Was it ever suggested in the working group that the money be forfeited to the general fund to be distributed as part of the regular budgeting process?
Madam Chair, I certainly brought up that topic, but it was clear that, and again, this goes to what happened to House Bill 3069 last session, it's clear that the primary motivation behind this proposal before you is twofold. One is to take the profit out of crime. Two, to make use of the proceeds from those forfeitures for law enforcement activity at the local level.
Well, so Mr. Fedanke, then your reading of the group is that the primary purpose is not to take the profit out of crime, but to
I wouldn't go that far. I would say that it's a twofold purpose. Again, the political background we're dealing with is a federal statute which up to now has allowed sharing of revenue with local governments from federal property seizures in drug cases. I believe that those forfeitures could continue under existing law. It is only that the proceeds from those forfeitures would not be shared with state and local governments under the new federal law.
Well, would it remove your objection? Let me just ask this way. If rather than being forfeited according to the scheme in House Bill 2282, these fruits were forfeited in such a way so that the profit went into the general fund and became part of a budgeting process which was somehow dedicated to law enforcement and then the were done indirectly, would that change your opposition?
We would rather not see it dedicated to law enforcement. As a practical matter, there would certainly be a great deal of political pressure on the Ways and Means Committee to see that those funds were used for law enforcement. But certainly, we believe, even with that kind of a proviso, that it would be a significant improvement over the procedures in the bill now.
Would it remove your objection, but deal with your
not
objection?
Entirely, but it would deal with the lion's share of it, Madam Chair.
Representative Minnis.
Mr. Fidanky, it seems to me that if we were to direct these monies to the general fund, that would be subject to greater pressure to increase the amount of forfeitures simply because the demand on the general fund is much greater. I don't know that we really would be achieving anything by December.